It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with Garrison Keillor about his new collection, The Keillor Reader. He'll also be performing, along with the rest of the cast of A Prairie Home Companion, Saturday evening at the Civic Center in Des Moines. And I was told just this morning that a few tickets have just been released to that performance. So if you don't already have tickets, you still have an opportunity to go and see that performance if you're interested. Again, that conversation coming up later this hour. My first guest today is Iowa novelist Larry Baker. He has just published his fifth novel, The Education of Nancy Adams, published by Ice Cube Press, and he's here with me today. Hello, Larry.
Charity, hello to you. Thank you very much for having me on. And, you know, I realize you don't have cameras in your studio like Rush Limbaugh or Don Imus, so nobody really knows that you're 7 feet tall.
Right, right.
And wear a tuxedo to work.
Completely
true. This is amazing. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Larry, I want to talk a little bit about the trajectory that you've taken, but let's start with The Education of Nancy Adams. And I'd love for you to read just a little bit from the beginning of the book to give us a taste of who this woman is.
Great. I'm going to read you the first four paragraphs. I have perfect vision and low blood pressure, assets that make me a great shot. I can sit on the dock that slopes away from my house and finish a box of shells in an afternoon. I like to shoot things, and that scares some men, a woman with a gun. Too bad it never scared the men it should have, because my theory is that being educated and being armed ought to reinforce each other, and I'm wrong. I used to watch my father shoot from the same dock 30 years earlier. He was a lousy shot, and my mother had always insisted that he keep his gun pointed toward the water of the St. John's River. Odd, I always thought to myself, because Daddy was much safer to be around than my mother. Frances Adams, my mother, had a short fuse, and dishes were always breaking if she lost her temper. Dishes and cats and pictures on the wall, nothing was safe, and I had seen her launch an empty coffee mug at my father, poor hapless Charles, and then they laughed at each other. My parents were strange. PhDs are not, teachers are not, mother hot and father cool, but cool in a good way. Two parents who adored their perfect only child, me. I could never make them as normal as my friend's parents. And like my daddy, I'm not a hunter, and I don't shoot in front of other people. I've got no illusions about protecting myself with either the .22 rifle or my small-gauge shotgun. They're always unloaded and locked away most of the time, and if I can't talk a murdering, raping, flesh-eating burglar into leaving, I'm in big trouble. No, I just like the feel of the stock on my shoulder, the imaginary line down the top of the barrel as I aim, the jolt as I fire, the sight of the target exploding. And I seldom miss. I wear earplugs, but not so thick that the explosion is simply muffled into a mere whisper. And the smell, I really like the smell.
That's Larry Baker reading from his new novel, The Education of Nancy Adams. And Nancy Adams comes across as a very tough woman right there in the opening pages. But she's a complicated woman.
It's a little bit misleading there in the beginning because you think she's really on top of things, but she's really a mess. She's 38 and has not worked, coming back to the town she grew up in, the job at the high school she graduated from, running out of money, drinking too much, and thinking that she's going to hook up with the man she was in love with 20 years earlier. And it takes her the entire first year of teaching to figure out where she's going from there.
She's also a woman, as alluded to in that passage. I mean, as a high school student, she was full of promise. Her parents considered her to be their perfect child. She was a wonderful student. She went off to Notre Dame and really never fulfilled that promise at all.
No, she went to Notre Dame and got married. Married a doctor, never had to work in her life until he died. And then she spent the estate and discovered things about him that sort of knocked her off balance. And then she gets a lifeline from her hometown and gets to start over again at the age of 38.
She doesn't strike me as particularly introspective.
Oh, Charity. She spends a lot of the time in the book having imaginary conversations with Henry Adams, the historian from Harvard. She's constantly trying to analyze, like, how the hell did she get there? How did I end up here?
She does a lot of looking at other people, a lot of judging other people, and not necessarily thinking hard about who she is.
Well, I think one of the things that she's going to have to do is other people, as she analyzes these other people, it always bounces back to her. She's analyzing her relationship with these other people and their relationships with each other. And slowly she uncovers some of the delusions she's been working under for all these years. And I do think she's a much more stable, introspective person by the end of the book.
Yes, definitely.
You have to take my word for
the,
it.
She seems to be almost emotionally stunted at where she was when she was in high school. Although she's had these life experiences, this marriage, and she's now a widow, in some ways she seems to have the emotional development that she had when she was 17 years old and still clings to the relationships that she had when she was 17 or 18 years old.
Yeah, and one of the things, one of the passages I get a chance to read later maybe is that a little bit more of her background, explain how she got to be paralyzed, I mean frozen. There's a section of the book where she talks to another character in a restaurant, and he's known for being a philanderer, a person who's just charismatically physical. And he talks about her not having a body, talks about her not being able to feel her body. And her girlfriend's always trying to get her to hook up with somebody. And she says, it's not a matter of like not, I want, it's not that I lack the desire. I lack the desire to have the desire. And she really has to break away from her past to become whole again.
Now, your first novel, The Flamingo Rising, was in some ways inspired by your own life, in many ways inspired by your own life. The main character in this book is very, very different from you. How did you approach writing an authentic 38-year-old woman?
Well, the most important decision a writer has to make very early in the process is, what is the point of view of this story? Is it going to be you, third person omniscient? Is it going to be like third person limited to focus on one character? When you go into first person narration, you open up all sorts of possibilities, but you're restricted to that person. And if your reader doesn't buy the person, then the book fails. I think Nancy works. I deal with her mind more than anything else. But, you know, the first version of this book was written 15 years ago, and she was a tiny character. She was almost a footnote. The main characters were the principal and this mysterious high school student the principal was socially taking care of. But that didn't work. And the rewrites and rewrites, I realized I needed somebody to tell their story. But once you have somebody tell their story, that person has to have a story too. And I thought, what would it be like to be someone who goes back to literally teach where you graduated from? What would it be like to be a woman? Women writers very seldom get asked, well, how do you write from a male point of view? Men writers always get asked that because the assumption is that basically we're like men in general. We're just louts and insensitive and, you know, not a level of empathy, and we're just...
Well, I think I would ask a woman writer that as well.
All right. But I think I just can only say that you judge Nancy after you read her and how well a writer writes her. I wanted a stretch for me, and that's certainly a stretch. And I found it fascinating because every writer will tell you at a certain point, once the characters are sort of developed, they start having a life of their own, and they sort of help you write the rest of their story. And that was true with Nancy. And when there's a couple of scenes in there where I went in thinking at the beginning of the day, I know where I'm going here. And then I don't understand the process. And no writer can really, you know, be scientific about it. But something happens and you start being a conveyor for that character as much as a conveyor of what you want to write.
Well, if she was a footnote in a story 15 years ago, how did she grow on you? Is this a character you return to again and again over the years?
No. I'm trying to think of a comparable character, except in 1985, I had to write a creative dissertation for the University of Iowa to get my PhD. And that was a book about politics, and it was about a guy running for political office. And he had a woman that was in love with him, and she helped him on his campaign. But she wasn't, like, it wasn't a first-person point of view. She was the secondary character to him. So that relationship of caring for somebody who doesn't really share the same feelings that you have towards them had already been planted a long time ago. And then when I started developing Nancy, I had already practiced that relationship in the first book, which is, by the way, sitting on a shelf at home and nobody will ever, ever see it. It's awful.
Well, that's part of the process for many, many writers, all the best writers, I'm sure. When it came time to publish this book, I mean, you've been through so many different experiences with the publishing industry. With this book, you chose to publish with Ice Cube Press in North Liberty, and you are doing an interesting rollout where it's already been released in Iowa, but there will be another rollout this summer, right?
Right. Actually, this is my third book with Steve at Ice Cube Press, who basically saved me. I mean, I owe him a lot. He's an amazingly talented guy who gives me a lot of freedom. I mean, I think his other writers will tell you the same thing. He really wants the writer to succeed. So he did A Good Man for me, my third book, and Love and Other Delusions, my fourth book. And on this one, the experience I gained from those first two books with him was that we didn't get any national reviews. We didn't get any attention outside of Iowa. And as Steve and other small presses will tell you, the biggest cost of small press publishing is the cost of the book itself, printing the book. You misjudge that, you lose money. So Steve is letting me do this approach where we're rolling out in Iowa only. I'm doing libraries, bookstores. I'll be at the Monticello Public Library next week, next Thursday, Beaverdale Books in Des Moines next Friday. But we're selling the books face-to-face. And in fact, we only printed 200 copies of the hardcover edition, and those are only on sale now at Prairie Lights here in Iowa City and New Bow and Cedar Rapids. And once they're gone, they're gone. The paperback will be released in June nationally, but we're not selling it on Amazon. And that's as much a philosophical decision about how I personally feel about the Death Star, but it's also a pragmatic financial decision, which is, once you throw in the cost of printing on a small run, the cost of sending it to them, their discounts.
We'll pick up this thread in just a moment. I'm talking with author Larry Baker. His latest book is The Education of Nancy Adams. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in about 15 minutes, I'll be talking with Garrison Keillor about his new collection, The Keillor Reader. Also, we'll talk about A Prairie Home Companion and, of course, its long history with Iowa radio. That's coming up in a few minutes. Right now, I'm talking with Iowa novelist Larry Baker. He's just published his fifth novel, The Education of Nancy Adams, with Ice Cube Press. And Larry, just before the break, we were talking about this unusual rollout that you're doing. So you've published the book in hardcover, but only in Iowa, and you will release the paperback in June, and that's a nationwide release, but you're not selling it through Amazon.com.
Yeah, we will sell an ebook through Amazon. I mean, that's the best vehicle for doing that. But basically, there's almost, on a small press, the profit margin through Amazon is tiny, and I can say cost is everything. So we're going to do that, but also that increases the importance of people actually going to bookstores to buy the book, going to libraries where I'll be appearing, or contacting the publisher directly. Ice Cube Press is on the web. Ice Cube Press, you can order the book through there. But basically, it's just a different way of selling books that makes the book more important than how you sell it. Even that seems like a contradiction. Steve was patient with me because he realized this potentially cuts down on the number of copies that you can sell. But once again, if we don't get the national reviews, nobody's going to know about it anyway. Now, all bets are off if Terry Gross calls or, you know, Oprah, who I was told I was going to be interviewed by, you know. But sure, we can change our plans, but pragmatically and financially and philosophically, this is something we want to do differently.
Your first novel, The Flamingo Rising, was very well received. It was published by a big publisher, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
And a lot of people still have this idea that if you have a big book as a writer, you're made. And you have found that not to be true?
Well, a lot of it depends on how you define made or success. Sure. My first book was published by Knopf. Big advance, big foreign sales, paperback sales, Hallmark movies. I cashed all the checks. But all of those are predicated on an assumption of the publishers that they will get that money back through sales. And my first book, quite honestly, if it had paid nothing for it, it would have been a bestseller. It would be great. But it didn't come close to earning back the advance. And once you do that, you are less attractive as a writer. And compound that with some dumb decisions I made along the way, which is basically like severing a relationship with a good agent just over personal reasons. As somebody else told me, you know, agents are not supposed to be your friends. They're supposed to get you money. I said, oh, now I realize this. I came down and we still continue to publish. And so I'm successful in this real sense. Steve at Ice Cube puts out very good books. I mean, I think Nancy is a great book. I'm very happy for that. I mean, I can hold that in my hand and I can talk to you about it and other people. And I'm a success. The book is out there. And once the book exists outside of yourself as a writer, I think you're a success. Too many people say, I got a story. I mean, I want to write this. I'm going to write that. Well, go ahead and do it. In fact, writing is the easy part. It's getting published is the hard part. And I am.
And selling the book after you get published. I mean, that's a step that a lot of people don't understand that writers have to be involved with
now,
or it's not going to work.
Yeah, especially the number of reviewers is down. The newspapers are down. Magazines are not printing as much reviews as they used to. I'm very thankful that I can get some attention in Iowa. And it's sort of like, this is the pond I'm swimming in now, and hopefully it will enlarge later. But, you know, I'm on the web all the time. I'm making phone calls. I've just set up a tour of Florida libraries. They are paying for me to come down there in Florida.
And the book takes place in Florida.
The Florida Literary Arts Council read an early copy of this that I sent them and begged them to read, and they chose it as their book of the year. They're going to fly me down there for two different tours in Florida college campuses. I'm doing better, I'd probably say, than 95% of the writers in America. But, you know, one of the statistics, amazing statistics about writing is like 5 or 10 writers in America account for 90% of the sales. So the rest of us, like this guy you're having on after me, I hope he does well. I've never heard of him, and, you know, give him my best. But basically, it's a pretty tough business out there.
It is, and it has changed dramatically.
It has changed a lot. There are more books being published, less reviews being published. Costs are going up. And so I keep telling people when they say, what do I have to do to become a writer? I said, don't. I don't need the competition. Go away. Leave me alone. Go print, type a book out and give it to your friends. Don't do it.
The fact that so few writers actually make a living writing, mm-hmm. I mean, very few writers in the United States or in the world right now can entirely subsist on proceeds from books that they write.
Yeah. And as much as I love Steve and Ice Cube Press, I'm not making a living off of this. It's very satisfying. I still have to teach part-time. And I know your listeners will not believe this, but I'm actually older than I sound. I have a patient and considerate and loving wife who has worked all of her life, and we retired. And so we're comfortable. Now, the first book paid for my house, paid for my kids' education, paid for my retirement. Every book after that has just simply been a book that sells a few copies. I'm playing too much of a martyr here. We're doing okay.
But why do it? I mean, you clearly have put – you've been a prolific writer. You've put a great deal of effort into both managing the publication process and getting involved in the publication process and promoting the books. What is it about having a book published that does make it all worthwhile to you?
Oh, that's an easy one because it's not a book. It's a story. I was telling stories before I was writing books. I have some skill with words. I can talk words and I can write words. So when I can tell this story, get this story out, and then actually show up and talk to people about it, There is no other pleasure like, well, you know, food and sex, sure, but and breathing. But basically, I think writers are the luckiest people in the world. And I don't understand the panic-stricken writer's block kind of writer. It's a pleasure to write, and it's a pleasure to see that book. And one of the things we haven't mentioned about Nancy is that this is a different-looking kind of book. Another thing, the reason I like Steve, we put together a book that looks different than other books, and you just have to pick up a copy to see why every chapter has visuals in it and epigrams. And it's a great-looking book, and I think it's a great story. And so it's like part of you. It's an extension. Writers talk about books being their children. Sure. It's a lousy metaphor, but we're very proud of them.
I'm talking with Larry Baker. His latest book is The Education of Nancy Adams. And let's get back to Nancy. Can you read a little bit more from the book for us? And set this up a little bit for us.
Okay. This is a little bit after the first section I read. More about who she is and why she is as sort of off as she is. I have a habit that my dead husband Jack used to make fun of all the time. I pick a point in my life and sum it up, or just a day, sometimes just the things that happened that day. And Jack said I was a control freak. I never understood that, because his own office at home had always been a mess, and he absolutely forbid me to touch anything. His office at the clinic was the same way, but his nurses loved him, and they would joke with each other about having to sort out his files if anything happened to him. And then he died in a plane crash, and I didn't touch his home office for a year. It was how I mourned. And when I finally made the effort to reclaim the space, to box it all up and store it away, it was then that I found his journal. He had been uncharacteristically meticulous. He listed names and dates. Jesus, thinking about it now, I'm surprised he didn't have pictures, too. It was the same day his partner called to ask me out to dinner again, and I finally accepted the invitation. And put a gun to my head today, I couldn't tell you that man's name. The latest list for me? I'm a childless widow. My mama and daddy are dead. No brothers or sisters. I'm 5'7" tall and weigh less than I did when I was in high school. I have almost no money in the bank and live in the house I grew up in. Home again, escaping the distant suburbs of Atlanta. I had no real job there. I'd been a substitute teacher in Atlanta when I felt like it, which was not all that often, but I hadn't stepped into a classroom since coming back home to Fort Jackson. And if I had any identity in Atlanta, it was as a book reviewer, mostly histories and biographies, never fiction. And in a good month, I'd have 2 reviews in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. But back in Fort Jackson, I had no identity. Oh, sure, I was Charles and Francis's daughter back in the old house. Her. I was a virgin, seriously, when I married Jack Vandegrift. I thought I was typical, the virgin thing. Jack had been 5 years older than me. After he died, I slept with a lot of men, most of whose names I don't remember. Too many times a man not named Jack, had asked me why I called him Jack. I told him it was my father's name, and that man seldom called back. And for a long time, all men were named Jack to me, and I saw him in them. I did it intentionally, call them Jack, tell them it was my father's name, and it creeped them out. Then it was time to go home. I was almost out of cash, so I sold my double-mortgaged house in Atlanta, headed back on I-75, back to live in the house in which I had spent the greater part of my first 18 years, and almost 500 miles later, in 7 hours of singing out loud to myself without music, songs my father had taught me when I was a little girl, Fly Me to the Moon, Moon River, some Janis Ian and the complete Carly Simon catalog, songs I had lip-synced in high school, all the Ann Murray and Neil Diamond hits and all the Harry Chapin ballads I could halfway remember, songs that my teachers had introduced me to after I moved to Atlanta. Singing to myself in a voice that couldn't carry a tune, I had pulled into my old driveway. I could smell the pines, and I had lost my voice. And the first thing I did was walk down to my parents' boat dock on the St. John's and stick my feet in the water. And I wondered how long alligators lived. And then I pulled my feet out of the water, wishing I had my father's rifle. And within a week, I had bought myself 2 new guns.
The book is The Education of Nancy Adams by Larry Baker. And Larry, the title of the book, The Education of Nancy Adams, is an echo of another very famous book, The Education of Henry Adams, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 1919. Was that a book? Is that a book that means something to you?
Oh, duh. Yeah. In fact, I purposely placed Nancy at the end of the 20th century, just like Henry Adams was at the end of the 19th century. They're both history teachers. They're both trying to figure out where they fit into the bigger scheme of things. She had to read Henry Adams in college and hated him. And so as she goes through her story now, she's constantly remembering parts of it and having conversations with him. And I remember at the University of Iowa, I took a course under Sherman Paul, 20th century culture. And he said, the 20th century begins with Henry Adams. And I think I want the 21st century to begin with Nancy Adams. And so by the end of this book, and by the way, this book, like The Education of Henry Adams, will win the Pulitzer Prize eventually because you have a lot of pull. By the end of this book, Nancy literally meets Henry Adams once again. And I won't tell you how that happens.
There is another theme in this book that also was something that you visited in your last novel, Love and Other Delusions, and that is a theme of inappropriate relationships between high school teachers and their students. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about why this is something that has you've visited more than once in your books.
Well, first of all, there is a big difference between those two books and those two approaches. The other book was about a college teacher, an older student. Okay. This one, the important thing in this one is all you have to do is pick up the newspaper or pay attention to the news, and this is all over the place. This book also deals with issues of homosexuality in high schools, bullying in high schools, rape, hormones. And in fact, there's one chapter in the book simply called Rumors, because the basic thread of this book is controlled by some people trying to figure out who is the father of the child of this unwed student. And because the principal, Nancy's old love, is a person taking care of this student, rumors start to fly about that as well. Was he the father? And Nancy has to figure that one out. So that world, that high school world, is reality. And this one, there are a lot of surprises about who really is sleeping with who.
There are also, there's a lot of infighting in the school among teachers.
Oh,
and with the school
shocking.
Board and all of that. Was that, I know you've spent some time in local government. Was that
Well,
was
I did my local government
inspired?
Book years ago, and that's why right. I never get elected to office again. The interesting thing, in preparation for this book years ago, I spent 2 weeks at City High School. I followed Amy Canellis around. She was a counselor over at City then. And I sat and talked to teachers, and what is it like? What is it like? And there's scenes in this book that are right out of that experience. The quote from the journalism teacher about the student newspaper being such bad taste, he says, high school is bad taste. Another teacher trying to explain why some of the teachers don't like the principal says, what, you think being educated makes you nice? It doesn't even make you smart sometimes. And finally, I'll leave you with this quote from Mark Twain, one of the chapters. In the beginning, God created idiots. That was for practice. And then he created school boards. So all the issues, and that is not, do not overinterpret that quote. Come on, folks. Don't call me at home. What are you saying? No. It's just the idea that students never realize the drama of the teachers' lives is just as messed up as theirs is. And it's a real closed environment. It's not like working in an office. You're working in an office, plus you've got people under you and over you, and you're controlling this little herd of kittens known as teenagers. And then you've got your own problems to deal with, and that's Nancy's world.
Because you've chosen to publish this book in the way that you have, the process of promoting the book and talking about the book is going to be very hands-on mm-hmm. for you. How long do you think you'll spend with Nancy Adams?
Through the fall, because I've already got book dates set up and tours set up. We're going down to Oklahoma this summer. We're going to Florida this summer. I've already got another project in the back of my head, and I need to finish that. I've gotten 200 pages written on another book. That's why I said I don't understand the concept of writer's block. My problem is just simply time to write. And I make a joke about the fact that my wife retired and she's home now, and it's like it's upset my entire schedule. And so, and if she's listening to this, I do apologize. But, you know, you're driving me crazy. Anyway, so I'll do this for another 5 or 6 months and hope to focus on another book after that.
All right. Well, Larry Baker, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Jerry.
Larry Baker is the author of The Education of Nancy Adams, published by Ice Cube Press, and he'll be at the Monticello Public Library next Thursday, Beaverdale Books in Des Moines on Friday. Coming up in just a moment, my conversation with Garrison Keillor of A Prairie Home Companion. This is Talk of Iowa.